This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
You're seeing a pivot in how developing nations are treating their environmental resources in many places around the world, and Malaysia is certainly part of that movement.
Over the last few decades, the skyline of Malaysia's capital Kuala Lumpur has mushroomed. A conglomeration of skyscrapers highlighted by the Petronas Twin Towers, two of the world's tallest buildings, now obscure the horizon in this rapidly developing city. Is all this construction a good thing for the country? And to what extent are developers and the Malaysian government considering sustainability in this building spree? To better understand the environmental costs and benefits of Southeast Asia's massive infrastructure developments, Manga Bay sent correspondent Keith Schneider to Malaysia. Schneider is our guest today on Sea Change Radio. He gives us an overview of the construction projects, compares them to those of Malaysia's neighbors in the region, and discusses the influx of Chinese capital flooding the country. As you'll discover, Schneider came away from his visit with a surprisingly optimistic outlook on the country's future. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Keith Schneider. Keith is an environmental journalist and an international correspondent. Keith, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
So you're in the midst of a multi-part series about Southeast Asian infrastructure for Manga Bay, and we'll point to that on Sea Change Radio. Most of the work is focusing on Malaysia. Why don't you explain the genesis of the project?
So most of my work over the last decade has been to write about energy, water, and food on six continents. So the intersections between rising demand for energy, rising demand for food, and the diminishing supplies of clean, fresh water around the planet. And Manga Bay and I have had a relationship now for a couple of years. I went to the Philippines last year for them. And they asked me this year to look at the massive infrastructure development that's occurring in Asia, and the string of cities from Seoul in the north, heading south, Tokyo, Beijing, Shanghai, Guangzhou, Shenzhen, Bangkok, Kuala Lumpur, Singapore, and Jakarta are the center of extremely impressive, in many ways, infrastructure development around rail transit, water infrastructure, some road development, mega real estate developments. Much of it financed and built by the Chinese. And Manga Bay wanted to know, well, okay, what are the consequences of this infrastructure development on the environment, on marine resources, on land resources, on forests? So I went to Malaysia for a month in April to find out.
And if you had to characterize these efforts by the Malaysian government in concert with Chinese developers, how would you summarize it? Is this something that is going to be, in the long run, detrimental for the environment, or does it give you hope?
I was very impressed with Malaysia. I didn't know what to expect. I found Malaysia to be one of those places, what I call the global garden of embryonic hope. One of those places like Mongolia and Panama and Costa Rica that you don't expect environmental enforcement, environmental values to be part of the economic development strategy. But it is in Malaysia, and it has been in Malaysia for well over two decades. So when you develop at the scale that is occurring in Malaysia, it really can't be done without environmental damage. And in my view, what Malaysia is doing, particularly on its rail development, is extraordinary and, to me, very hopeful for the future, because it's diminishing reliance on automobiles, which are, if not the leading cause of climate change in the world, the second leading cause, and certainly a major cause of CO2 pollution in Malaysia. So it's diminishing reliance on the automobile. It's diminishing the level of forest cover that would be cut in replace of highways. So highways would be much larger corridors, and it's leading to dense development patterns which saved land. So Kuala Lumpur, which already had a roughly 200-kilometer rail network, metro rail network, was going to double the rail network in Kuala Lumpur with very fast, modern, clean 50-kilometer rail lines. But the other thing that occurred in Malaysia while I was there is an election. So the massive infrastructure development had prompted the leader of the country, Najib Razak, the prime minister, to dip into the pool of capital that flows when those major infrastructure developments are being planned and financed. And the country is in the midst of a massive corruption scandal, which led to a change in administrations. So Najib's $100 billion infrastructure development program has been scaled back by the new prime minister, Mahathir Mohamad, who ran on a campaign that A, severely criticized the corruption practices, and B, the costs of some of this infrastructure development, particularly some of the big rail projects that are proposed in Malaysia.
So maybe you can give us an overview of the projects that you covered in order to kind of give us an idea of the scale and the magnitude of it.
Under former Prime Minister Najib Razak, who started in 2009, his administration, proposed over $100 billion in infrastructure development on both Peninsula Malaysia and in the two states on Borneo, Sarawak and Sarawak. And these projects were pipelines, ports, new rail lines, new real estate development projects, including a $10 billion new financial center being built in Kuala Lumpur on 70 acres of land in downtown Kuala Lumpur. And I looked at other real estate projects and development projects that weren't part of the former prime minister's program. Two of them were a huge seabed reclamation project to house 300,000 people and businesses on Penang Island, which is offshore of the west coast of Malaysia, and an $11 billion transportation infrastructure project involving roads, rail, a tunnel, and a gondola on Penang.
And the river restoration project that you covered is one that left me surprisingly very optimistic. Why don't you kind of give us an idea of this mega project to clean up Kuala Lumpur's rivers?
So under the former Prime Minister Najib Razak and previous prime ministers, Malaysia has embraced what I would consider a pretty strong set of values around environmental safety and economic development, putting those two values together. And one of the projects that I discovered in Kuala Lumpur was a $1.3 billion restoration of the Klang River, which is the river that runs through Kuala Lumpur, which is the river where the city was founded. And the idea under the former prime minister was to clean up that river, restore its ecological health, in order to help revive and strengthen the downtown economy of a city that is the center of a 7 million population, metropolitan region. And what Najib was after was to help make Kuala Lumpur competitive as a place to live and do business as Hong Kong and Singapore, his Asian neighbors. The consequence of that restoration project was impressive. I mean, the river is being restored. Certainly not the only time this has been done around the world, but there's a very strong move globally to restore watersheds, to restore rivers, to restore stream banks, to restore shoreline. That is to turn cities toward their water resources instead of away from them, as we did in the 20th century when they were sewers. So by cleaning up those rivers cease to be sewers. They become ecologically cleaner, which invites more people to be around them and more businesses to be around them. And former Prime Minister Najib personally, supervised this and oversaw this river restoration. He dedicated it, he started it with launched it in 2012, and he was a pretty frequent visitor to its shoreline through his administration, which ended with the election in 2018.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to journalist Ken Schneider. He's a correspondent for Manga Bay. So, Ken, what was the biggest takeaway you had from this River of Life project that you checked out in Malaysia?
Well, as you know, the South Koreans did in Seoul, as Oakland is doing in California, as New York has done with the Hudson River and the East River, Kuala Lumpur and the Malaysian government have redesigned the shoreline of a river that's essentially encased in concrete. And so the river is confined by these massive concrete channel, which had been, prior to this project, almost unwalkable, certainly unvisitable. People didn't go there. So that river, for about 2 or 3 kilometers, has been completely redesigned to be a promenade. It's much like what Shanghai has done around the Hongpu River in their downtown, overlooking the massive, magnificent skyline in downtown Shanghai. And by the way, it was an American company, AECOM, that kind of put together the design and the master plan for the River of Life project. It's a $300 million project, that aspect of the $1.3 billion project. And the idea is to make it really easy to get to the river side, the shoreline, the promenades. And at night, they light it with these beautiful cobalt blue, mystical, magical, romantic lighting. And they put the river water through this misting system. So for, you know, many, many hundreds of meters, the river is this cobalt blue, misty, cloudy, you know, romantic promenade in the dark. It's quite compelling. So I was very impressed by it and how it was executed, you know, on budget and on time as well, which is really difficult to do with multi-billion-dollar infrastructure projects.
Now let's turn to one that didn't impress you as much, the island of Penang, which I've been to. I think the title of this segment of your series kind of says it all. In Malaysia, an island drowns in its own development. So how is Penang Island drowning in its own development, Keith?
So, Nina, in the 21st century, we're seeing a conflict between the 20th century patterns of development and the 21st century ferocious ecological responses. And Penang Island is one of those places around the world which is in, you know, right in the dead bullseye of that conflict. So Penang has been developing at breakneck speed since the 1960s, when an American planning company had suggested to the Penang Island authorities to, you know, end the joblessness and the poverty on the island by recruiting high-tech manufacturers to the island for jobs. That worked really well, and Penang's population has soared to 755,000. It's one of the most densely populated places, you know, in Southeast Asia. It's become a mecca of tourism. Development is rising upward in 30 and 40 story residential towers, all of which have led to paving over much of the island. The island's built environment is now 4 or 5 times bigger than it was before all this development started. And all that built environment has paved over the forests, quite a bit of the steep hillsides that are on the island, and a lot of the rice paddies and the rubber plantations. And so there's less open ground for water to be absorbed. And this is coming at the same time where Penang is being pounded by the heaviest rains that it's ever experienced. So less than a year ago, between mid-September 2017 and the beginning of November 2017, the island had 3 successive storms that dumped more water than at any time in the island's history. And the long story short is it caused flash flooding, massive, massive landslides, and 18 deaths. And so it invited this new reckoning on Penang about the hazards of living there, and certainly the hazards of developing the way that it's being developed. So Penang has a very sophisticated and influential environmental community that's raising these questions about what are we doing? I mean, how are we going about this? Because, you know, we keep doing this given the meteorological trends that are now occurring not only in Penang but across Southeast Asia, which is experiencing, you know, massive storms. Does this make any sense? And it's a very big conflict because the island authorities continue to want to press for more development. So there's a massive reclamation project on the south end of the island to house 300,000 people on some 1,500 hectares, more than 3,000 acres of new land reclaimed from the sea, which would displace a pretty sustainable fishing community there. And there's this 11 billion-dollar proposal to completely change the transportation system there in order to handle the traffic, which is already the heaviest in Malaysia.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Keith Schneider. He's a correspondent and an environmental journalist. You mentioned in passing, but we haven't really delved into the influence of China, its investment in Malaysia. First, tell us the investments that Chinese real estate developers are making in Malaysia. And after your visit to Malaysia, maybe give us a feeling for how the Malaysians view this influx of Chinese cash.
First, Malaysia has developed its modern state in successive waves of foreign investment. So in the 80s and the 90s, it was Japanese, it was Korea, it was the West, Europe and America. And the newest wave of investment is from China. And China is busy expanding its sphere of economic influence across the world, and especially in Southeast Asia. So Malaysia is right in the bullseye of China's economic strategy of expanding its reach through the region. The biggest Chinese government project that I reported on was in Kuantan. Kuantan is on Malaysia's eastern border on the South China Sea, and there China is participating with Malaysia government in building a billion-dollar port expansion for the Kuantan port in order to allow much bigger ships to dock there and to receive materials there. Chinese government-owned companies and Malaysian companies are building a set of what they call manufacturing bases. And these are multi-square mile places that are going to have, that there's a steel plant being built there by the Chinese government. There'll be palm oil plants, there'll be chemical plants, there'll be high-tech manufacturing plants there in these manufacturing bases that employ thousands of people, some Malaysians, some Chinese nationals. And this area was where the East Coast Rail Link, which is this 688-kilometer fast train line, which was proposed for the west side of Malaysia to the east side of Malaysia, it would have several stops in this Kuantan area. And what is this? So this is all part of what China calls the Belt and Road Initiative. And the Belt and Road Initiative is a five-year-old Xi Jinping idea, which is to spend well over $1 trillion to link Beijing and Shanghai and Guangzhou and Shenzhen to 70 countries around the world, basically to put rail lines, ports, new energy infrastructure, hydropower plants, electrical generating plants from Beijing into Europe, Beijing into Africa, and Beijing down to Jakarta. And that project is well underway. The Belt and Road Initiative has built major infrastructure like what I just described in Kuantan, in Pakistan, in Myanmar, in parts of Turkey, Bangladesh, all through Africa. And what China is trying to do is to basically command the world trading system. They're trying to interfere and intercept and take command of global trade, which they're doing in part thanks to the Trump administration, which is doing its part to roil the same trading system that the United States basically developed and has managed and commanded much of it, you know, since the end of World War II. The environmental consequences in Kuantan, to me, seemed much lower than in other other places around the world. I mean, China's Belt and Road Initiative is building a new rail and ports and pipelines through Indonesia that threatens endangered species. The World Wildlife Fund has said that the Belt and Road Initiative, if it occurs as planned, would intercept or invade habitat for well over 200 endangered species. In Malaysia, it's not nearly as clear that that's occurring, as particularly Peninsula Malaysia. The new administration canceled two Chinese pipelines right after I left Malaysia in May that would have damaged tropical forests on Borneo, on the two Borneo states of Malaysia. So that is a plus for the environment. But where I was, the environmental consequences of what was being done there, to me, seemed pretty negligible. And that's a comparative, because I've spent a lot of time in India, and I spent a lot of time in China. And both India and China have wrecked their landscapes, wrecked their water, seeking to duplicate the Western development strategy in the United States and in Europe. Malaysia isn't doing that.
Why don't you explain what Forest City is, and do you think that this could be more of the same as what you've seen from Chinese investment elsewhere in the region, or do you think Malaysia will enforce its environmental values?
Forest City is a brand new, modern proposal to develop very dense city on four reclaimed islands in Johor Bahru, which is the southern shoreline of Peninsula Malaysia, right across the Straits of Johor from Singapore. Half of the first island is completed. 16,000 residential units have been built and sold there. And overall, the master plan of this community was developed by a group called Sasaki, which is a Boston-based architecture design and planning firm. And, you know, my sense about this is that it has real potential to be a big plus for the world. And the reason I say that is that A, Country Gardens is very sensitive to attention to this project because of its scale. So it's proposed as a $100 billion brand new city of 700,000 people on a very dense geography. So 3,400 acres, about 6 square miles. Consider that Seattle is 57 square miles. Same, its city boundaries are 57 square miles. For 700,000 people. So just in terms of land conservation, it's much more land friendly than how we develop cities until now. B, Country Gardens made some missteps as they started. The project is part owned, 40% share roughly, by the Johor government and its sultan. And Country Gardens started construction without having the proper permits to reclaim the island or to do any of the things that it did when it started in 2014. And it was called on that. And it's been suffering the political, social, cultural consequences ever since. And it's been, you know, bending over backwards to make amends for that. So building those islands, you know, when you reclaim the sea, there's going to be disruption. And there's been disruption down there in the seagrass beds, in the fishing communities there, and in the mangroves along the coastline. The question is, A, will the natural regrowth of those seabeds and mangroves come back when it's done? What are the ecological consequences when it's finished? And what the developer argues, and with what some of the ecological scientists that I talked to assert, is that it has the potential to be a winner, not a loser. And what the developer says is, look, we're not putting this on land where it could disrupt, you know, tropical forests, farming, agriculture. We're putting it in the ocean. We're doing it really, really densely. The reclamation projects are large, but the area has the capacity to regenerate the seagrass beds in that strait. Just the ecological conditions are such. And that's been proven because there's a nearby port that had in expanded dramatically. It had damaged, ruined the seagrass beds near it. And those seagrass beds, after the construction was done, this has been several years, have completely recovered.
So what about the steel plant and chemical plant that are being built around Kuantan Port? These are largely Chinese backed projects. Is this kind of a case of what the U.S. has been doing for years, which is moving its manufacturing of more polluting industries, offloading them into other countries where there may not be as strict regulations?
Well, and that very concern is expressed by the environmental community in the Kuantan area. Are we being, you know, the victims of China, you know, exporting its polluting industries? And the answer to that question is, to what extent does Malaysia enforce what is really, you know, good water, good air quality laws, good land reclamation, land conservation laws? The question is, in the 21st century, with developing nations like Malaysia, will the government allow new developers to pollute their air and their water outside the limits that they impose? And that's a question to be answered. Malaysia, as I say, has done a pretty good job in establishing its policy infrastructure for environmental safety and enforcing it. They've done a pretty good job. They've got a lot of their natural bounty that's still intact. They are enforcing the law against polluting industries, much, much different than what you'll find in India and China, which also have decent laws but don't enforce them. China is trying to make a pivot on that. India is an absolute mess. I was there in May, and it was dispiriting to see how, you know, India is backtracking on its ecological conditions. It's getting worse there. In fact, I was really concerned that, you know, the ferocious ecological conditions of the 21st century could so disrupt India that the democracy just dissolves. I mean, it's just crazy how polluted it is in India. Malaysia is not that. Malaysia reminded me much more of Panama, where I was in Panama in 2016. 2015, I spent a month reporting in Panama. Again, none of these, there's no perfect place, but Panama had very strong environmental ethic. They've conserved almost 800,000 acres of forest land in the Panama Canal Zone, both to protect the water resource and, of course, to ensure the tourism economy in the canal zone. They've done a really good job in protecting their rainforests. The big question there is how they're going to, you know, produce their electricity. So there's a very vigorous fight over hydropower development there. Panama City had established a new wastewater treatment plant in order to clean up its bay. The city itself built a new rail line, a metro line, underground metro, to begin to reduce traffic congestion. You're seeing a pivot in how developing nations are treating their environmental resources in many places around the world, and Malaysia is certainly part of that movement.
Environmental journalist Keith Schneider. Keith, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. Appreciate it.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Breakestra and Bob Dylan.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.